This episode of Does Not Compute is brought to you by Datadog. Datadog makes it easy for dev and ops teams to monitor their entire stack. How? They provide a unified view of all the systems, apps, and services in use. Out of the box, Datadog integrates with AWS, Postgres, Kubernetes, Slack, and over 200 other applications and services. They also make it easy to build custom integrations that talk to whatever other systems you need. Datadog has lots of tools to help you visualize and act on your metrics. Their end-to-end request tracking makes it simple to visualize performance. Algorithmic alerts, such as anomaly detection and alert forecasting, help you make the most of your data. Of course, Datadog also has pre-built and fully customizable dashboards, so you can view your data in the way that makes the most sense to you. Thousands of companies rely on Datadog to help them collect, visualize, and alert on all their metrics. They provide a truly full-stack view of the systems, apps, and services that you use. To learn more, head to datadog.com/doesnotcompute. When you sign up for a free trial and create a dashboard, they'll send you a free Datadog t-shirt. Check out datadog.com/doesnotcompute today to learn more and sign up. Cool. 1, 2, 3. Did you clap?
Yeah. We were so weird. In sync. We clapped. As one, space and time folded in on itself, and our hands were hitting at the same time in the same moment in space.
It's a beautiful thing. Beautiful things that happen in the podcasting world.
That's what I was just channeling my Neil deGrasse Tyson.
It's the magic of recording.
Yeah.
How you doing, man?
I'm very tired today, but other than that, I'm doing good. Doing well, rather.
I feel like we haven't talked in a long time, but that's just because we work with each other now, and so we're talking like constantly during the week.
Well, that too, and we have like offset schedules, so
yeah.
we have maybe a couple of hours during the day where we're kind of overlapping in working, but other than that, you know, you're working later when I'm off, and I'm working earlier when you're not around, which is kind of nice because I was talking with Scott about that. He noticed that it's kind of cool because there's someone always around whenever they're. Whenever they're working or working with clients in stores and in onboarding and stuff, there's always one, like either you or I are always there.
Yeah. My kind of ethos with work is that I try to be sort of like just an entity that floats around. And if you need something, I kind of appear and then I disappear, work on things in the background until I'm needed again.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because we use Twist as a company, but you and I don't use Twist. So,
right. Yes. The
thing that I think dumps the most chatter into the dev channel is the GitHub bot.
Man, I have loved that too. Honestly, Twist overall, really pretty impressed with so far. I think it's neat.
It's not bad. I mean, there's some things that could be smoothed out for sure, but it's funny because when I describe it to people or say that we use Twist, I get kind of some cynical responses like, "Oh, isn't that just email?" I've gotten a few salty tweets when I mentioned that we use it. They're like, isn't it just email, you know? And I could tell the person was like sipping on their latte and kind of chuckling a little bit when they hit enter. And it's not. Or people just kind of say like, oh, you know, isn't that just like a Slacker ripoff? I'm like, quite a bit different, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely much less of a focus on real time. There's not even typing notifications, are there?
There are. In the chat. Okay. Well, not in the threads, but in the chat.
Not in threads, right. Yeah. So yeah, it's split up into two things. There's threads and then there's messages. And threads, my understanding of this so far at least, that's like mostly automated stuff posting in there, and then you can reply to it, but it's kind of just like it's basically just like an email thread. It is kind of just like email.
Exactly.
But then messages is the real time component, but it just feels a lot less. I don't exactly know what it is, but it feels a lot less intrusive than Slack does for me.
Intrusive was the word I was thinking of, too. It's just kind of there, and it's there when I need it, and it's not there when I don't need it or don't want it to be. And it's been working pretty well. There's not a ton of us either that are chattering away, but what's kind of cool is that with threads is that when a thread goes in, people that need to see it, and it lives there. You know, there's nothing covering it up. There's nothing kind of pushing it back into history. It's not like tucked away anywhere. It's like its own dedicated place. So I scroll through every day and I look to see what's been added, and that's about it.
Yeah, I feel like at least for the size we are right now, and the way that we're using it, it is really, really good. But I do kind of think about sometimes if we were a larger company, that it might be a little much, at least in some places.
Sure.
But as for right now, I think it's really nice and it's doing the job. And I mean, if it, you know, doesn't, I'm sure we'll reevaluate that. But
yeah. Well, I can't even imagine being a large company that uses Slack.
Right.
It seems like it'd become untenable really quickly. And I know a lot of people do, and that's fine, but like we use the Octopus quite a bit and, you know, we had, four times more people than we have right now at Design Collective. And there's just lots of things that get lost in kind of conversation or in the real timeness in Slack. And the threads in Slack don't really serve the same purpose, I think. So it's kind of like, imagine you're in a busy hallway and you want to start a new thread. What you would do is you grab the person you want to talk to and you kind of like dip into like the entryway of a classroom. You don't go into the classroom, you just sit in the entryway for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what Slack feels like. Whereas Twist feels like, okay, so if you have a discussion to talk about this, you go to that channel. Like, so if it's a feature request, you're in the feature request channel. And then each request has its own thread. So you can walk down a hall and see each room labeled, this is what this room is for. And the discussion happens in that room. But you still have the real-timeness of the hall, which is the chat section. So you can still walk up and down and talk to people in real time. But when you need to talk about something that's isolated, you dip into that room. And it's still different than just having a dedicated channel for things. You have a channel with actual organized threads. I don't know.
The messages in the threads seem more considered generally to me.
Yeah.
It's like somebody will do a bit of a write-up on something they're thinking about, a paragraph or two, and then send that through instead of just like, hey, I had this idea, one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more structured. And I think that's really good for features. I mean, especially we're really trying to focus on taking our time and thinking things through and making sure that we're making the right decisions.
Yeah, that's
and,
been
and
nice.
I think this kind of helps enable that by giving us a space to really consider things.
Yeah, that's been really nice. It's a noticeable difference in the change of pace post-Paul and pre-Paul in the way that I work. I noticed that I actually program a lot less than I used to. And this is something I've been thinking a lot about and thinking about the future. And obviously things keep going well for DK and we keep growing and stuff like that. But like, how much time I spend programming versus how much time I spend looking through the feature requests and bug reports and managing the project in GitHub, because I don't think we've talked about that yet, but we just have a project that's called WIP and we put stuff in that and that's where we work from. So like at the beginning of the week, I'll get my marching orders from Lindsay and I'll put those into GitHub and I'll drag the things that are needing to be addressed into the WIP project in GitHub and then we'll just Kanban board it around. So whenever you tackle something, you assign it to yourself. When I tackle something, I assign it to myself. We drag it around and close it. And so I find I spend a lot more time reading now than I did before. So I'll go through and Twist and I'll go through like a feature request and I'll look for anything new. And what I've been doing, and this has worked pretty well for Scott and the sales team, is if they put a thread in like a new feature request, what I'll do is I'll add it to GitHub and I'll put the GitHub issue number in the thread's title. So that way, when I'm scrolling through Twist, I can see what's been acknowledged and what's in GitHub and what hasn't been. And they know as soon as something has a GitHub number and then like 1, 2, 3, they know that it's been added to GitHub and slotted into the queue.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of an important thing too, is that we are actually using, for a lot of our longer form communication, for our chatting, we're just using Discord.
Mm-hmm.
But for our longer form stuff, I've been putting all that, and you have pretty much too. I don't think we've even really discussed this. It just kind of happened. We've been doing that mostly in GitHub, which actually does also get sent to Twist, so everybody else can see that.
Yeah.
But that's been working out really well, and having that cross-linking between what's going on in Twist, where non-technical folks can enter things and discuss things, and then where we're actually talking about more implementation details and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Having that connection is really nice, but also at the same time, the bit of separation.
Yeah. So we used to have them put stuff directly into GitHub and it just became untenable because there are lots of duplicates happening because they're on the road, you know, they're driving around. They can't like take the time. I mean, they could, but it's just harder for them, you know, to take the time.
Well,
we've got almost
90 open issues right now.
Yeah,
something like that, and it's unrealistic for other people to be in there and like, is this a duplicate? Has this already been asked by somebody else? No, it's like there has to be some translation layer.
Yeah, there has to be. And so it works pretty well having the separation. But one thing that I didn't even think that would happen that's kind of delightful is they do look at the automated chat, GitHub chat. So like when we have it post, like if I post a comment, it'll post that comment in the GitHub channel in that thread. And what's funny is that our coworkers will actually respond to that, and they'll like they'll drop in their ideas, which I didn't really see happening, but they do, and I think that's really cool because we'll say something or like close this or opening this, and Lindsay's like, great. Also, have you thought about this angle? And I'm like, I haven't. Let me update GitHub. You know, it's just cool that we don't have to like do that twice. It just kind of happens, and that I think that speaks a lot to the coworkers too, that they're looking for that information. You know, we're not like sending it to them, they're looking for it.
Absolutely. I mean, I've set up integrations and notifications along these lines like everywhere I've worked for a long, long time, and basically nobody ever looks at them.
Yeah.
And so I'm still kind of getting used to having people look at them. It's surprising in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like you're much more careful on how you structure comments and notes and things, cuz my GitHub issues are like mini novels. I'll have like research. So I use Markdown for the formatting. So I have different sections for each, most issues that I add. So I'll have like a research section. I'll have a hypothesis section if it's a bug and I'm trying to guess why it's happening. I'll have like a to-do list usually in most of them. But it, you know, it's nice for them to see that. But I found that I spent a lot more time doing that now. So I guess before it would just kind of happen naturally where I would be going through. And as I'm picking things out, I would kind of do that. But now I've noticed that I actually have more scheduled times where that's what I'm doing. So previously it felt like that was more of a byproduct of working. It was a byproduct of actually doing the work. And now I'm finding that to me, that's becoming more of what work is going through that stuff. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's always a weird feeling when your job changes underneath you a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice because I don't mind doing it. I like organizing stuff, you know. But it's just interesting because I've been reading. I went on to Medium and just searched for CTO, and some things are bad, some things are good that I found. And I was like, oh God, no one really knows what they're doing or talking about, really. Just lots of opinions being thrown around. But that was a lot of it. Was like a lot of the articles were about, okay, how do you decide when you should stop coding. Obviously, that's not something that's happening to me anytime soon because there's just two of us. But a lot of the articles are kind of about that, like deciding, okay, when you do the programming, it should be something that's like clear and cut and defined and you can be productive versus when you're doing the other CTO things, which is like trying to make decisions that guide the business, make the decisions that kind of fit, like making sure that you're making decisions that fit the business goals and drive the business towards where you want it to be going, which was interesting. So really, I guess I've never been a CTO before. And so I'm trying to figure out what the crap I'm supposed to be doing. And before it was easy because I was the only programmer. So now I'm like, okay, well, got to write the code. That's how I get the business to where it needs to go. And so now there's two of us. It's like less exaggerated than someone running a full company. But now there's like different areas that I can focus on, you know? And so I was reading about like the CTOs and like reading about like all these different terms that people come up with, like VP of development or VP of engineering and stuff like that, trying to figure out like what people think the distinctions are there. It's a very strange world.
Yeah, I've never been able to get into titles.
I haven't either. It doesn't like,
I just want to go somewhere and I just want to go somewhere and feel like I'm helping.
Yeah, it feels weird to me like looking into that stuff, because I could honestly, so like Lindsay and I had that talk when we were talking about bringing you on, like what are the titles? And I was like, it doesn't matter to me. It really doesn't. I don't feel like I need to be CTO or the VP of engineering or whatever. Like you said, just call me a programmer because that's what I'm doing, you know? But yeah, it's just weird. It feels like grown up things trademark, you know, grown up things TM when I have to like look up that stuff where I'm thinking, or like people, when people ask me. I was in the bookstore this weekend, and this guy was talking to me about what I do basically. And so I was telling him about what we do, and he was asking me all these grown up TM questions. And I was like, I don't know. He's like, are you publicly traded? Are you privately held? Are you, like, you know, what are you, a $50 million company? What are you, like, he was asking me, like, making all these assumptions and asking me questions. And I was like, man, we just started. There's, there's four, there's five of us, you know.
Man, people will come up to you and just ask really weird questions or just say weird things.
Yeah.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah. It was interesting. But that's what it feels like. It feels strange because I'm going to be turning 31 this year. So I'm a grown up, you know. But it feels different because I never really thought that I would be in a position where I needed to look up some of those things or like learn about some of those things, or it's just weird, you know, growing up.
Yeah. I don't think anybody ever really ends up where they think they're going to.
No, but
for better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm enjoying it and I think you're enjoying it by the vibe that I'm getting, and you're doing killer work, which also helps me enjoy my life and work as well. But I don't know. It's a cool phase, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been, honestly, so far, probably the best job I've ever had by a pretty good margin.
That's good to hear.
So far.
Yeah, it's cool. So it's cool. Man, it's like, I knew that you would like Elixir. And when I first started digging into it, I was like, Paul, there's a lot about this stuff that Paul will like. And I'm glad that assumption is kind of been validated a little bit. So what's funny is I always tell people that I've shown you two things in life that you like. The first one was Vue, and when we first like stumbled upon it, it was like 0.14. It wasn't even 1.0 status.
Old,
you know, it was
school.
Super yep. new. And we're like, oh, this is awesome. We're just going to use it because we think it's cool. And then it ends up exploding. And I felt kind of the same way about Elixir. Now Elixir had gained a lot more steam by the time I found it. You know, I found it because of the hype, but it was one of those things where like, Lindsay, I think this is it. You know, we should bet on it. And she said, okay. So we went it all in and rewrote the app, you know?
Honestly, when you were first talking about it, I was a little dubious because, you know, you hop around tech a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit here and there now and again. And then I started digging into it more. I was like, this is really cool, but it's a totally different paradigm. And I'm kind of worried about having to pick up this functional programming thing for real and actually work in a language that is pretty drastically different in a lot of ways than other languages I've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, the learning curve has been not that bad.
It's not that bad. It's
really,
really
not. It's intimidating. It's intimidating to get into it. And there's some weird stuff, and there's lots of stuff I'm still acclimating to. Mm-hmm. But really, overall, I mean, I'm 2 weeks in, and I feel relatively comfortable now.
Oh, yeah.
I still get confused, and I still get confused and have to jump around a bunch of different files, and I'm definitely not up
well,
to speed yet.
I think part of that, too, is institutional knowledge, like you say. Like, what was the thing that we were dealing with? You asked me a question, and I was like, oh, that's because of this. And you're like,
some bug I was running into.
There was no way you would have ever had like been able to infer that from anything. And I was just
it would have
just
been hours of fiddling and Googling.
Yeah.
But it's just a thing that you know. I mean, this is, and every company has this of every size.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just funny because it was just there in my mind. I was like, oh yeah, that's because of this. And you're like, what? But no, it's been great. So we talked a little, I don't know if we talked on the show about, because we've always raved about Heroku, and I still love Heroku. And it's like some of our Heroku works fundamentally, you know, the stateless system, the container system is just at odds with OTP and stateful servers, which is what we're kind of trying to work towards, you know, the web app being a stateful thing, because that's what the web is. There's nothing, I have nothing against Heroku at all, but we've talked a little bit about like moving away, which kind of scares me a little bit because Heroku does so much for you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And today I kind of made the first step towards that, and I switched off of a Heroku. So we were using Papertrail for our logs, log stashing and searching and stuff. And I found a company called Timber that makes a really slick product for the same thing. It just feels very much more modern than Papertrail does. And so I moved us off of a Heroku app, Papertrail install, onto a non-Heroku hosted Timber logging setup.
Yeah, I saw that PR come through. That's pretty exciting. It looks like a really cool service. I haven't dug into it a whole lot yet, but it definitely, compared to a lot of other logging services I've used, it just looks more modern. Like you were saying, it looks like a little bit more thoughtful, I guess.
So yeah, the big selling point for me was you can assign it a context, or you can associate a context with a log as it gets sent through. So to make a practical example of that, they have a feature called user tailing. So So as Phoenix is a plug-based application, a plug is just a layer. So you take data, you pipe it in, and it comes out, just transformed a little bit. So you can basically make your own plug, and you can assign the current user into the Timber context. So that way, as someone uses the application, the logs get sent to Timber or can be associated with your users. So in the Timber UI, there's actually the user's email or name or username, whatever you want to use. I think it's just defaults to email. So you can tap on the email and then it filters all the logs to that user's context. So you can literally see the trail of like the logs associated to just that user, which is going to be incredible for debugging, because usually when there's a problem, Scott will be like, yeah, this so-and-so user is having a problem. So now I can just go and find that person's email in the logs and I can see specifically their traffic.
Yeah, that's a big, big deal.
Yeah. And then because
it kind of changes how you look at logs.
Yeah, for it me, does. At least. It almost makes it feel kind of, it's like a stack trace almost, you know, like, so the other thing,
a stack trace for the session, basically.
Yeah, basically. And so the other thing is that, because they have an Elixir plugin, they can gain more meaningful information from the Phoenix stack. And so they have a number of plugs that they insert into the stack. And so you can actually see in the server logs, when a route comes in, it'll tell you what controller action and function it calls and how long the template takes to compile and render and everything, like how long the response takes, the whole request and how long it takes to go through the stack and return HTML or JSON, which is also pretty nice. So before in PaperTrail, we'd only see really the Heroku logger. You know, you would see like a GET request, you'd see the response time, maybe the IP address. But now we can actually see the controller action that it hit. So you can see like which pipelines it went through, if it was protected, unprotected, you know, all that stuff. So there's just a whole new level of detail in there. So it's, for me, it was kind of like killing two birds with one stone in moving off of a Heroku app space setup and kind of pulling in some more of those modern features for the logs.
Yeah. And I think it's important. You mentioned like, this isn't necessarily something against Heroku. It's just, it's like a fundamental difference in philosophy, basically, of how you want to manage servers and how Elixir OTP in general encourages you to structure things. And you're missing out on a lot of the benefits that you could get in terms of scaling and all that.
Yeah.
If you do things the Heroku way versus just having actual servers.
Yeah, it's a whole discussion. It's a whole thing.
Which I'm sure we'll be getting into as we move more and more towards that.
But. Yeah. Yeah, it'll allow us to actually simplify things on our end, which is kind of cool, but we just take on more responsibility. And so I actually talked to Lindsay about that, and she basically said, whatever you think is best. And I was like, okay. So there's that.
You're Mr. CTO.
That's true. It's funny because that's literally my job. Is, should we move off of Heroku? You know, kind of like considering that. And obviously you know what? I actually consult you with pretty much every decision, which I think is good. It's like, I should be doing that, you know, which is awesome. And we're about to be making a lot of changes, which I'm really excited about. Now you are too. And I'm really excited to be talking about this eventually, because I know they're hashtag buzzwords, but like with GraphQL and Absinthe and that whole direction, Apollo and Vue Apollo and Nuxt and all the Vue hashtags. You know, that we could fit.
It's just a giant, bucket of hashtags, basically.
Really, it is, yeah. But no, I'm excited. I'm excited about it. There's, you know, I usually don't like to pick topics for these shows. I like to talk about them, but I would like to, we've been making a lot of decisions and thinking about like how we're structuring this Elixir application that I think that we could talk about that might be interesting. Like the whole idea of presenters that solved a pretty big problem that we were having too.
Is that something, do we want to start planning for the show? Is that what you're saying? That seems crazy, man.
Maybe people can let us know if they want us to actually plan something.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm not opposed. That'd be kind of cool.
It was pretty cool though. Like coming up with that solution and then the next day seeing a press release basically for a new package that came out that kind of solved the same problem just in a drastically different way. And I actually preferred my way, I felt like that was like a milestone achievement. I was like, wow, I actually think that I did a better job. Solved better
for
specific.
Your case.
Yeah. And felt good about it. It felt good.
Probably less of a generalized solution, but still. No, I That is one of the things. I think we kind of keep coming at this and saying this in slightly different ways every week, but I really do feel like I have the freedom in Elixir to go and figure out what the best structure is to solve whatever problem, the exact problem I'm facing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a general solution that solves problems similar to mine that can maybe be extended, but actually just how to write the thing that I need. And I just feel like I feel weirdly empowered, I guess, by that. It just in terms of being able to write better code, which is weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is kind of, it feels so, it's interesting because, I got to start writing more blog posts actually for this stuff. So I actually did write one that recently I can, self-promote talking about my 2018 development environment setup, but it's been, so we were talking about that a little bit this last week too, about how Phoenix kind of encourages you to separate. It encourages good application design, like 1.3 does. And so I think that's a direct result, like that feeling of being able to do that is a direct result of decoupling the actual business logic from any sort of presentational layer. That would be like a web controller or like a WebSocket channel or anything like that. It kind of like, it basically forces you into two schools of thought, right? So like when you're working on the Elixir side, the non-web side, you're thinking about building a public API for data, writing data, reading data, the ACL stuff for that. It's all kind of like separated into that area. And then when you're working on the actual controller side in the web folder, it's different. You're thinking about servicing that data to the end user, but then you're just using the data API that you designed previously. I think that separation is really powerful because it gives you the ability to completely focus on one side of like one aspect of something when you're working on it.
Right. Well, when you're building out that API to be consumed by Phoenix, by the web layer, when you're building out that API, you're focused on like what's the best way, what are the best decisions I can make for this API, not how do I best fit this into my web framework.
Yeah,
they're just two entirely separate questions, and then you tackle them separately, and it just makes things nice, man.
It does, and then upgrading or deprecating endpoints. So first of all, with Elixir 1.6, it deprecated. I don't know what to call it. I don't know what the term is. It's not like a macro, but being able to specify when a function was deprecated, what version is pretty cool. But being able to, so like, let's say you don't like how, like we don't like how spread out some of the contexts are for marketplace. Well, okay, if we wanted to just make a new data API for that, all we do is make a new folder and build it. You know, we could literally leave the thing as it is, make the new folder, build it, test it, and then swap out functions one by one.
And this isn't like a hypothetical thing either. We've actually been doing this. Like yeah. I did a PR this week that was basically all this. There was an old API and stuff was like duplicated code and all that. And then that got consolidated down in one place. And then I just went through when I had a bit of time to do it, I just went through and did that. I just moved all, I just did like a global find, looked for all the places that were calling the old code, and then moved them over to point at the new code. And then got rid of the old code. And it was just like, it didn't all have to be done at once. That the new code had been in place for a while and we knew it was working well. And it was for really simple stuff like date formatting.
Yeah. But yeah. Oh yeah.
It was just, but it's like that is a real, this is like a real tangible thing that you can start getting the benefits of almost immediately. It doesn't have to be a giant refactor. It's just an everyday way of looking at writing and rewriting code.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been the most amazing thing to me. The fact that you can, you're like, at that point, you're less than 2 weeks in. My thought when I saw that pull request was like, that was fast. Because I saw you had assigned the issue to yourself, and then the next thing I know, there's a PR for it. I was like, what?
Yeah, gotta scrub that code base clean, man.
Yeah, and not only that, but you went farther. So the issue was only for like date formatting. So making sure that we're using, so basically what I did was I made a formatter module, and the formatter has like formatter dot, dates, formatter dot number, formatter dot whatever. And so basically each module just has a collection of functions that are kind of suited for formatting things for display and how Design Collective likes them to be formatted. And you not only did dates, which was what the PR was or the issue was for, you also did the currency.
Right.
Which
well,
was,
I figured I was already in there. I might as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's been interesting too, like thinking about how my mind has changed about writing applications and using Elixir, and I think I'm kind of like settling into what I think the sweet spot is for how Design Collective works and how the code should be structured and things like that. And it's going to be cool to like see down the road how that looks. But I mean, it's already like things are already getting way more complicated, you know, as I keep talking about more, there's just more permutations of everything. And it hasn't been that hard to keep up with, and it hasn't been that hard to test, and it hasn't been that hard to, keep things straight in my mind. And I think that's a huge testament to, again, the guides around Phoenix in contexts, but just that idea of like bounded contexts, not necessarily going all in there, but that's that distinction and separation, I think was, for me, that was like a game changing thing when I thought like, oh, you can build your business logic over here and then use that code over here. And it doesn't have to be intermingled. It's like, you can do that. And suddenly Node made sense to me, like even though we're not writing Node apps. So like, I think it gets weird because, and I'm not trying to give Rails a bad name, but like that was my introduction to building apps and MVPs was a Rails application. And it's very opinionated and it's built a certain way. And so when I started learning Node, I was like, this feels very strange. It doesn't make sense to me. And then I think Elixir is what made it click. I was like, oh, this is, you can totally separate these two. And then I look back at Node, I'm like, oh, that would make a lot more sense. And I could probably build a Node app now if I wanted to, because my mind has been liberated. Maybe that's a strong way to say it, again, because I don't mean like that in negative terms towards Ruby or Rails at all, but it had
just that's a way of like thinking that wasn't really working for you.
Yeah. Exactly. So I would look at Node and be like, I don't get it. This seems really spread out and whatever, but now it makes sense. It makes total sense.
Oh man. I'm excited. This is going to be a good year, man.
It's going to be.
As we almost enter March already.
Yeah, I mean, things are looking good. You know, we got stores coming on. We had two stores last week come in, and we got stores coming in from, because before we were just in Southern California, and now we have store, like we have a store from New York in. We have, I don't like want to talk numbers and stuff, but we have sure. A good chunk of people that have responded back or they're basically saying we want to join the platform from all over the country. So things are looking really good. It's just a matter of maintaining pace and maintaining simplicity and you know, just churning down those, that whatever 87, and I think it's like 87 issues right now we have in there. Just like
too many,
settling into a rhythm.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, it's always good to talk.
Yeah,
I guess we'll be talking in a couple hours.
Yeah, it's gonna be Monday, and then
it is.
I have a lot to get done this week. A lot of shipping stuff to do that I didn't get done last week because I was thinking about the presenter stuff. I keep calling it decorator, but we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. I'll write a blog post. Maybe I'll start a blog post about it. And if anyone wants to hear more about that specifically, just feel free to like message me or hit me up or tweet at me or whatever. But basically it's about the case where like, okay, so you have a product. And a product can have virtual fields on it. And products in Design Collective have a lot of data that's unique to the current user in the current context that the product's been viewing. And so the problem was, okay, how do we make sure that a product always has that information available? Depending on if it's preloaded from another association, depending on if it's, you know, coming from an API where it's actually surfacing products or something. So I thought I came up with a good solution. So if anyone's interested, I'll write a blog post about it.
It is a good solution. I'm happy with it. I think I get to consume it pretty shortly actually.
Yeah.
Probably tomorrow. So I'll have better opinions on it tomorrow.
We'll find out. So when in doubt, just emulate the language that you're writing in, and it'll usually work out pretty okay.
No problems.
Yeah. So far. All right. Well, I will message you in a few hours, like you said.
All right. Sounds good, man. Talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye. Our thanks to Datadog for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Datadog makes it easy to collect, visualize, and alert on all your metrics. They connect with over 200 applications and services out of the box, and you can easily build custom integrations for anything else you need. Datadog provides lots of tools to help you visualize and act on your metrics, including anomaly detection, alert forecasting, and end-to-end request tracking.
Visit datadog.com/doesnotcompute to start your free trial, and you'll get a free Datadog t-shirt when you create your first dashboard. Sign up today at datadog.com/doesnotcompute.